That's what I'm talking about. VOA Weather Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Anna Mateo and I bring you two stories about recent winter storms that have hit several parts of the United States. Later, Armin Kasabian answers a question on Ask a Teacher. We close our show with an American story. This week, it is William Wilson, Part 1. But first, many places across the United States have faced extremely cold and dangerous winter weather in recent days. This includes states like Texas and Oklahoma, where such severe winter storms are uncommon. The lack of planning and preparation by leaders in those areas left locals without heat, water, gasoline, and other critical services for many days. At least 20 people have died this week. Experts warn that deadly weather will be hitting the U.S. more often, and that the country needs to get better at dealing with it. This week's storms fit a pattern of worsening extremes under climate change. They also demonstrate that local, state, and federal officials have failed to do enough to prepare communities for extreme and dangerous weather. "This is a different kind of storm," said Kendra Clements. She is one of several business people in Oklahoma City who opened their buildings to shelter homeless people. Some of them came in with frostbite, hypothermia, and ice in their hair. The storms served as a predictor of what social service providers and governments say will be increasing needs among the nation's poorest people as climate and natural disasters worsen. Other Americans are at risk as well. Power supplies of all kinds failed in the extreme cold, including natural gas-fired power plants that went offline in icy conditions. Some wind turbines froze and stopped working. The crisis has raised concern for power systems throughout the country. As climate change worsens, such severe conditions will become more common. Sarah Eftek-Harnejad is a professor of electrical engineering and computer science at Syracuse University in New York. She called the week's storms an anomaly, or unusual and unexpected. But such anomalies, she said, are likely to happen more often as a result of climate change. "There probably needs to be better planning, because we're starting to see more extreme weather events across the country," she said. "That could be in the form of severe cold like in Texas, or intense heat waves like the one California experienced last year that fueled deadly wildfires." Michael Craig is a professor of energy systems at the University of Michigan. He said the events in California and Texas show that what we have now is not going to do it in the face of climate change. It's only going to get worse from here. In Texas, wind power is a growing source of electricity. But most wind turbines operating there are not designed for very cold weather. "Making small changes to wind turbines is one step needed to deal with climate change," said Roy McCann. He teaches electrical engineering at the University of Arkansas. Some Republican politicians, including Texas Governor Greg Abbott, have tried to blame wind and solar power for the massive outages this week. However, traditional power plants, which depend mostly on natural gas, provide the majority of power in Texas. They were the larger problem. Joshua Rhodes is a researcher on energy issues at the University of Texas. The entire system, he said, was overwhelmed.
A Texas town on the Gulf of Mexico has been experiencing a record-breaking winter storm. The people there are facing difficulties that come with such extreme weather, power outages, and shortages of food, water, and gas. But the people of South Padre Island are also facing another difficulty: cold, stunned sea turtles in the surrounding waters. Cold, stunned sea turtles float to the surface where they can forget to breathe and drown. They are also unable to avoid harm from boats or other dangers, such as hungry animal predators. For the past several days, wildlife experts and South Padre Island locals have rescued nearly 5,000 sea turtles from the icy cold conditions.
So this is the largest recorded cold stunning event in history. In 1980, an organization was created that tracks these kind of events. And it is the single largest cold stun event that they have ever tracked.
That is Wendy Knight. She is executive director of Sea Turtle Inc. The nonprofit organization is responsible for a large part of South Padre Island's coastline. The organization has been helping to treat the majority of the cold stunned sea turtles, with much help from the community. During the month of February, temperatures on the island are usually between 17 and 21 degrees Celsius. However, temperatures this past week were much colder, between 4 and 9 degrees Celsius. This unusually cold weather led to a massive sea turtle cold stun. Alan Foley is a marine biologist with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. He explains that cold stunned sea turtles are not actually injured yet.
But in cold stunning events, the turtles aren't injured. And even though their bodies are affected, it's only a temporary thing. Once they get into a little bit warmer water, they quickly rebound and are perfectly fine. It's a lot of work and it's a lot of turtles in some events, but the end product is you have a really high success rate.
To save cold stunned sea turtles, Foley says quick action is critical.
When turtles are rescued and protected from scavengers and predators, and they're put into temperatures that are okay for them, within a day or two or three, their chances of survival in places like Florida and Texas are really good.
Knight says she is in awe of how South Padre Island community members have come together to help the turtles while dealing with struggles of their own.
It is awing. We've had hundreds, even thousands of volunteers participate in this process. Most of those people have not had power, electricity, heat. They have personal tragedy happening in their own lives. And they're spending 12 and 15 hours a day with us and our staff, that is awing when people put their own needs aside to help something that cannot help itself.
Many people in the community helped in the rescue effort, including leaders in business and government. Ed Com is executive director of the South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau. When Sea Turtle Inc. did not have power and needed more room for the rescued turtles, he opened the doors to the convention center. The large building itself did not have power during part of the storm. Knight describes the community-wide help as Herculean, or requiring great strength and effort.
Ed, the South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau opened their doors and let us put 4,200 sea turtles on the floor of their convention center. It's Herculean, the efforts that people have put in.
Cold stuns, Foley says, happen often, but they are usually not as big as the one Texas is experiencing. Florida, he says, also had a large one back in 2010.
And actually, in Florida, we pretty much have cold stun turtles every year, just not thousands.
While the events can be hard on the turtles and the volunteers who save them, cold stuns give scientists valuable information about the animals. Sea turtles can be secretive animals, Foley explains. But during a cold stun event, those secrets can be learned. Foley says that once a cold stunned sea turtle comes on land, it can be tagged and studied. Scientists can examine the movement of a sea turtle and also observe its changes in growth, disease, and injuries. For Wendy Knight, the recent cold stun has shown her something else. It has been a lesson in how effective a widespread community effort can be.
And the collaboration between Sea Turtle Inc. and the South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau and the city of South Padre Island is proof of that.
I'm Ana Mateo.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Abrahan Ferrer, who is in Spain. Hello there. I'm writing to you because I'm quite confused with these three options here. Up to, until, and till. I don't know how to use it properly. Could you explain these words to us, please? Thank you very much for your support in teaching us English. Keep it up. Dear Abrahan, thank you for your message. Let's start with until and till. They can be used as prepositions to describe time. The structure in this case is preposition plus period of time. Here is a simple example sentence.
Until yesterday, John did not realize that until and till had the same meaning.
And also,
till yesterday, John did not realize that until and till had the same meaning.
Until is used to show the time when a situation, activity, or period ends, as in,
I was up studying until 3 in the morning. I am so tired.
Until is also often used with deadlines, a time by which you must complete something. At work, your boss might give you a deadline. The boss may say,
"You have until Friday to finish the report."
Till can be used in place of until in most sentences. Here is one such example.
I can't wait till next week. I will finally get to see all my friends at school again.
Up to is a bit more difficult to describe. It can act as a preposition or play a part in a phrasal verb or phrasal expression. But here are a few very general ideas. Up to can be used to show the place or level that is reached by something, as in,
"The mud was up to our knees."
Up to can also mean as many or as much as a given number or amount. For example, imagine a person buys a very large car. The person might say,
"My car holds up to 12 people."
Here is another example. Imagine you have just taken a major exam. You really want to know your results, but you have to wait. A worker at the testing center tells you,
"You will have to wait up to 3 days for your test results."
The worker might also tell you this,
"You will have to wait until Monday for your test results."
Notice that the worker uses until in this case because Monday is a time, not a number or amount. Of course, up to has many other meanings, but we can talk about those some other time. Well, Abrahan, we hope this helps to answer your question. And to our listeners everywhere, what question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Armin Kasabian.
William Wilson, Part 1.
Let me call myself, for the present, William Wilson. That is not my real name. That name has already been the cause of the horror, of the anger of my family. Have not the winds carried my name with my loss of honor to the ends of the earth? Am I not forever dead to the world, to its honors, to its flowers, to its golden hopes, and the cloud heavy and endless? Does it not hang forever between my hopes and my heaven? Men usually become bad by degrees, but I let all goodness fall from me in a single moment, as if I had dropped a coat. From small acts of darkness I passed in one great step into the blackest evil ever known. Listen, while I tell you of the cause that made this happen. Death is near, and its coming has softened my spirit. I desire, in passing through this dark valley, the understanding of other men. I wish them to believe that I have been in some ways in the power of forces beyond human control. I wish them to find for me in the story I'm about to tell some small fact that proves I could only have done what I did. I would have them agree that what happened to me never happened to other men. Is it not true that no one has ever suffered as I do? Have I not indeed been living in a dream? And am I not now dying from the horror and the unanswered question? The mystery of the wildest dream ever dreamed on earth. I am one of a family well known for their busy minds. As a small child, I showed clearly that I too had the family character. As I became older, it grew more powerful in me. For many reasons, it became a cause of talk among friends, and the hurt it did me was great. I wanted people always to do things my way. I acted like a fool. I let my desires control me. My father and mother, weak in body and mind, could do little to hold me back. When their efforts failed, of course, my will grew stronger. And from then on, my voice in the house was law. At an age when few children are allowed to be free, I was left to be guided by my own desires. I became the master of my own actions. I remember my first school. It was in a large house, about 300 years old, in a small town in England, among a great number of big trees. All of the houses there were very old. In truth, it was a dreamlike and spirit-quieting place, that old town. At this moment, I seemed to feel the pleasant coolness under the shade of the trees. I remember the sweetness of the flowers. I hear again with delight, I cannot explain, the deep sound of the church bell each hour breaking the stillness of the day. It gives me pleasure to think about this school, as much pleasure, perhaps, as I am now able to experience. Deep in suffering as I am, suffering only too real, perhaps no one will object if for a short time I forget my troubles and tell a little about this period. Moreover, the period and place are important. It was then and there that I first saw hanging over me the terrible promise of things to come. Let me remember. The house where we boys lived and went to school was, as I have said, old and wide. The grounds about it were large, and there was a high wall around the outside of the whole school. Beyond this wall we went three times in each week, on one day to take short walks in the neighboring fields, and two times on Sunday to go to church. This was the one church in the village, and the head teacher of our school was also the head of the church. With a spirit of deep wonder and of doubt, I used to watch him there. This man with slow step and quiet, thoughtful face, in clothes so different and shining clean. Could this be the same man who, with a hard face and clothes far from clean, stood ready to strike us if we did not follow the rules of the school? Oh, great and terrible question, beyond my small power to answer. I well remember our playground, which was behind the house. There were no trees, and the ground was as hard as stone. In front of the house there was a small garden, but we stepped into this garden only at very special times, such as when we first arrived at school, or when we left it for the last time, or perhaps when father or mother or a friend came to take us away for a few days. But the house! What a delightful old building it was! To me, truly a palace. There was really no end to it. I was not always able to say certainly which of its two floors I happened to be on. From each room to every other, there were always three or four steps either up or down. Then the rooms branched into each other, and these branches were too many to count, and often turned and came back upon themselves. Our ideas about the whole great house were not very far different from the thoughts we had about time without end. During the 5 years I was there, I could never have told anyone how to find the little room where I and some 18 or 20 other boys slept. The schoolroom was the largest room in the house, and I couldn't help thinking it was the largest in the world. It was long and low, with pointed windows and heavy wood overhead. In a far corner was the office of our head teacher, Mr. Bransby. This office had a thick door, and we would rather have died than open it when he was not there. Inside the thick walls of this old school, I passed my years from 10 to 15. Yet I always found it interesting. A child's mind does not need the outside world. In the quiet school I found more bright pleasure than I found later as a young man in riches, or as an older man in wrongdoing. Yet I must have been different indeed from most boys. Few men remember much of their early life. My early days stand out as clear and plain as if they'd been cut in gold. In truth, the hotness of my character and my desire to lead and command soon separated me from the others. Slowly I gained control over all who were not greatly older than myself. Over all, except one. This exception was a boy who, though not of my family, had the same name as my own, William Wilson. This boy was the only one who ever dared to say he did not believe all I told him, and who would not follow my commands. This troubled me greatly. I tried to make the others think that I didn't care. The truth was that I felt afraid of him. I had to fight to appear equal with him, but he easily kept himself equal with me. Yet no one else felt, as I did, that this proved him the better of the two. Indeed, no one else saw the battle going on between us. All his attempts to stop me in what I wanted to do were made when no one else could see or hear us. He did not desire, as I did, to lead the other boys. He seemed only to want to hold me back. Sometimes with wonder, and always without pleasure, I saw that his manner seemed to show a kind of love for me. I did not feel thankful for this. I thought it meant only that he thought himself to be very fine indeed, better than me. Perhaps it was this love he showed for me, added to the fact that we had the same name, and also that we had entered the school on the same day, which made people say that we were brothers. Wilson did not belong to my family, even very distantly. But if we had been brothers, we would have been near to each other indeed, for I learned that we were both born on the 19th of January, 1809. This seemed a strange and wonderful thing.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.